Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, I have a feeling this is going to be relatively short and sweet.
Absolutely.
What are we drinking?
We are drinking a fine vintage of H2O this evening.
So it's going to be that kind of podcast. We're drinking water.
Water from the tap, nonetheless.
Well, this evening we're going to talk about two documentaries and one Canadian indie. There's a reason this is kind of short and sweet. There's a lot we just did not see, and for various reasons. We did not see the week's biggest release called The Circle, because they didn't screen it for critics, because when that happens, the studio has a faint idea of what it's like. The Circle, let's see, Dave Eggers, based on that 2013 novel, Dave Eggers, starring Tom Hanks and Emma Watson.
I know. You would think, what could possibly go wrong? And the very last, I think, performance of, what's the name of the guy who just recently died?
Pick one.
Oh, man. Bill Paxton. So it's his last film appearance.
Well, I was very interested in the director, James Ponsoldt. I've seen three of his previous films, Smashed, The Spectacular Now, and Into the Tour. Into the Tour was, what, from 2 years ago about David Foster Wallace? Jason Segel and Homeboy from The Social Network, Jesse Eisenberg. Yeah. I love those movies. Like, he was 3 for 3. So as much as the scuttlebutt I'm hearing about this film is that it's not very good. I wonder if that's from all the people who read the novel and are disappointed by the film. Who knows? We don't get to know.
Yeah, but it's a shame. I'm curious about it because it's got a very timely topic. You know, it's sort of based on this whole somebody who goes to work for an internet company and privacy and
skullduggery,
and freedoms.
Huh?
Yeah. So it's a shame that they didn't screen it for us, because I would have gone, and to me it means that there's probably something wrong with it.
We did not see How to Be a Latin Lover. And it's misleading, so I thought, okay, this is going to be a Spanish film. It's got Salma Hayek in it, but it's not. It's directed by Ken Marino. This is a guy from Children's Hospital, and Rob Lowe is in it, and Kristen Bell, and yeah, How to Be a Latin Lover.
Another one where you would think by the cast,
they did screen it for critics, but
they did, but the critics who saw it were not very impressed.
Another one we didn't see, because they didn't show it to us, is called Slight, and it's about a street magician, and that's all I know.
Yeah, so we've got a lot that we didn't get to see, but for no fault of our own.
But what we did see, batting leadoff, is called Finding Oscar. Finding Oscar is, I don't know, it's a tale of two halves. One half is gut-churning. Early 1980s Guatemala, therefore you know there's a civil war going on. Imagine Ronald Reagan praising Guatemala, saying we got to keep the Soviets out. But inside Guatemala, the Guatemalan military is chasing these leftist guerrillas. They're calling everybody communists, and when they go to this one village, a village named Dos Eres, they massacre the entire village, rape most of the women, and throw everybody down a well, most of them alive. Mm-hmm. How did that make you feel watching Finding Oscar?
It was a tough watch, because you just realize, I guess the sad part is a lot of people aren't really familiar with this story, and to see how complicit, I guess by their silence, the U.S. government was in kind of praising Guatemala's president while this stuff was going on. And certainly the Guatemalan government was directly involved in this massacre. So that part was kind of tough. I mean, it's modern history. So it's another one of those stories where it wasn't all that long ago. And so it just makes you realize, like, how does this stuff keep happening in the world? And so I'm glad that this particular story is getting a spotlight on it. It is a tale of two different it's a tale of two movies, because I kept waiting for the Oscar element of Finding Oscar to come in, and you really don't get back to the notion of who is Oscar and where might Oscar be until I would say a solid hour into this hour and plus documentary.
The whole Oscar part of the documentary you're talking about, I think, was by far the lesser half. By the time we got there, I didn't really care who Oscar was, and I didn't care where he was, and once you find out what happened to him, it's anticlimactic. This movie should be about the village of Doceres. They dig up these perpetrators. The guys who actually did it are on the screen staring into the camera saying, "This is what I did. I marched this little girl to the well, and she was crying. I said, 'It's okay, you're going for a vaccination.' And then I threw her inside alive," and he's like, "And that guy over there, he's the one who threw in the first infant." And I'm pretty familiar with Guatemalan history, and I think the more you are, the more you'll understand and really connect with Finding Oscar. I mean, the Eisenhower administration technically kicked off the Civil War themselves. They overthrew the president in the 50s, and everyone was still fighting about it in the 80s. They finally started some sort of reconciliation program in the 90s. This is where this picks up in the 90s. A state prosecutor, like the newest hired state prosecutor, is assigned the case of whatever happened to Doceres. And she has no support, no funding, no nothing, but she comes first full circle. And so, yeah, it's a tale of two halves. That first half is soul-crunching. I mean, it really shakes your moral compass. And did you catch the executive producer?
I believe I did. I think Steven Spielberg, correct?
Spielberg.
Yes. And so this has some heavy hitters behind it, because you had Spielberg's Shoah Foundation, and it's, you know, one of those Kennedy Marshall productions. So it actually had, I think, that extra level of funding behind it that it was able to be put together as well as it was. The fact that they had so much footage to work with from the excavation, the original excavation of this well where these bodies were discovered, and then when they were taken for identification by people, and then the DNA testing that was underwent, they actually had documented, you know, they were able to find the documentation of a lot of these moments. And I think that's the only reason you see a documentary like this, a story like this, actually make it to the big screen, is because they had the resources to tell it well.
I want to ask, why Oscar, two little boys, a four-year-old and a five-year-old, made it out of that village? Because the people killing everybody just stole the boys, and they brought them to their respective families and raised them as their own. Why not the other guy? The other guy, his name was Ramiro Cristales. He remembers the massacre.
Yeah.
He remembers it, and he's crying in the camera describing his mother and his siblings, and Oscar, you know, has nothing to contribute. But Ramiro has everything to contribute, but the movie's not called Finding Ramiro, it's called Finding Oscar.
Yeah, that was a little odd in the end, except that I think it's constructed very much like a 2020 investigation or a Dateline, one of those ones that kind of waits until two-thirds of the way through to kind of reveal the twist and the turn. And I think that's kind of what happens with this, is that, you know, because that other guy was found earlier, and you didn't know what Oscar would know. So you're kind of just waiting for the hints and to find out where this is going to take you. And the Oscar part is somewhat anticlimactic, but at the same time, there's that moment where there is a little twist in the narrative, and you kind of get goosebumps when you realize that you are learning some of this information about the massacre and about Oscar's family at the same time that he is. And so I found that, I actually found that rather compelling, and that's what kept me in it. And it's two different halves, but I think both bring the story, it brings a story full circle. You suddenly realize two-thirds of the way through why the film began the way it did and where you were at the beginning of the film.
Well, the director, Ryan Suffern, and his co-writer, Mark Monroe, who
Yay,
I believe you actually
Mark.
Know,
yes.
They made a choice. They made this into a mystery, and they didn't have to. They said, you know what, this might work well as a mystery. And I don't think it actually was the best way to go. They're actually after the fact here. NPR's This American Life did this already back in like 2012, and it was engaging, and that one was a mystery. That strung you along. This one just didn't have to repeat that. They just could have tweaked it in a different direction. Didn't have to be a mystery, and because of the mystery, it's less impactful for me than it would have been.
Well, and This American Life has, I assume that was just a radio version.
Absolutely.
Of the story, and so I think sometimes there's just different different narratives that can be told when you have video that you are also having to rise to the surface. And it's very challenging. You know, there's no voiceover. There's no, even though Mark Monroe is credited as a writer, this is one of those cases, as most of the things that he often works on, because he's a news guy. He was a news guy back in the day. And so this movie is constructed very much like what we would call a NatSat package, where there's no scripting of words. There's no voiceover. You are relying on interview bites to just carry it through. And the entire story is told through interviews. And so,
except for those, there is a narrator when they're unredacting State Department embassy cables and they're reading three things could have happened to Dos Aires.
But they're reading the documentation. Yeah,
absolutely. Yes.
It's not that it's a scripted story in any other way. You don't have an anchor, as you would in This American Life, or somebody telling this story and then interweaving sound. You rely on the interviews to tell the story, and that's very challenging to do. And so, considering all the different players that they had to work with and the footage that they wanted to be able to show, I mean, there's some compelling stuff when you see these decomposed bodies, these skeletons, and the clothes that are still like left on these skeletal bodies. It's that's where it really it pulls you in, and you think about the human aspect of all of this. And I think Oscar is the focal point because I think they felt that we just needed to have that one focused human mystery element to keep people engaged. So as documentaries go, I enjoyed this one. I thought it was an interesting story that I just really was not aware of.
All right, our second documentary is completely different. It is called Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent. Jeremiah Tower is a chef, and some say he is the first ever celebrity chef. You go to the restaurant to, eat the food, but really experience the chef who's hanging half in the kitchen, half outside the kitchen, getting the crowd pumped, making sure everyone's enjoying themselves. And I guess before him, chefs were confined to the kitchen. Okay. Parents, moms, and dads did not celebrate the fact that their child was a chef. So you learn about that, and another, I believe, and you could agree with me or disagree with me, I'm interested to hear your thought on this, another tale of two halves.
Mm-hmm.
First half, Jeremiah is a child. Very remarkable, very odd upbringing, which I enjoyed. It's just, you just don't hear about childhoods like this anymore. Second half, the restaurants. His first restaurant, Chez Panisse. Second restaurant, Stars. Much later, third restaurant. They focus on the restaurants and not so much about Jeremiah Tower. That's why I say this is another tale of two halves. Not as good as Finding Oscar, in my opinion.
No.
Still engaging. I still give it a thumbs up if and I wouldn't say go to this if you're a foodie, because it's not about the food. It's about a man. It's about restaurants, which is another odd choice I'll get into a second. But first, I want to hear what you thought about this.
Well, I would say it is still going to have a certain appeal for the foodie or for anyone who watches Iron Chef, the Food Network. There is an element to this that will appeal to the people that already really enjoy, Mario Battaglia or, any of these Kitchen Nightmares type shows. He actually would have been, I think, the first host of a Kitchen Nightmares kind of show because he really did, he was a perfectionist and he, was admittedly not a nice guy when it came to how he interacted with people in the kitchen, but he was still very much admired for his skill. But I do agree it's a tale of two halves. I found that first half, I guess even as the film progressed, the first half was even more strange to me, that they used so many different devices throughout the course of this film, that at the beginning it is the recreations of his childhood, and there's a hint of an incident of sexual abuse that kind of colored the rest of his life. And but then you suddenly have, Martha Stewart pop in and talk about him. And it was just a weird mix. Anthony Bourdain is one of the executive producers of this. And so it's got Anthony Bourdain popping in and talking about what an influence Jeremiah Tower was. And So you just had this mishmash of like a dramatic reenactment flashback type of documentary followed by a reality show treatment.
You mentioned Anthony Bourdain, and yeah, he was the producer, but a bit more. He's the creator. Like, this is his idea. He wanted to make a documentary all about, I don't know if it's his friend or not, but a man he respects very much, Jeremiah Tower. He says there's a historical injustice has been done to Jeremiah. He does not get the credit he deserves. His first restaurant he just walked into, it was Chez Panisse, and the lady who owned it, April Water, said, do something to the soup. He did something to the soup, and it was good, so they kept him on, and he was there for like 8 years. And they parted on sour terms. He accused her of stealing his menus and ideas for a book she published, claiming all the ideas as her own. So he started his own restaurant. That ended badly as well.
Because of the earthquake.
Maybe. They give about five different reasons.
Yes, yeah. They go back and forth on the reasons.
And then they jump to the present. There's a missing 25 years there mm-hmm. where the movie kind of alludes to the fact that he was just wandering the Mexican desert staring into the sunset. There's a lot of shots of there.
Yes.
And that contrasts with the first half, his childhood, which apparently he grew up traveling, wealthy traveling. He lived in hotels, these fancy hotels, where there were no other children. And you don't talk to children at the dinner table if there's other adults, so he studied the menu, absorbed the menu, and that's how he learned all about creating fascinating menus. And he goes off to Harvard, and to tell you what his Harvard was like, they made an amateur Molotov cocktail out of a Dom Perignon bottle and an Hermes scarf. So that's where he's coming from. I didn't care for the third act. He gets another gig. Save this restaurant that nobody likes. Tavern on the Green. I've never heard of it, but I can understand it.
No, Tavern on the Green, and maybe you're just a little young.
I don't hang out in Central Park.
But it doesn't matter. Tavern on the Green, like in the 1970s. I mean, it was a venerable institution in New York for many, many years. And it was the go-to place for everyone to see and be seen. And so it deteriorated, and so it was sort of, it had lost its luster. So bringing Jeremiah Tower on board was in this sort of effort to revive that the past glory of Tavern on the Green. And he probably, it was a thankless task that he wasn't going to be able to do it any better than the next guy. But so it was a stunt casting, you know, to bring him on and to get him. But it wasn't, I didn't understand why, like how he suddenly chose that as a reason to come back into the fold after disappearing for years. And that's never explained.
Yeah, apparently he wants back into life and society. There's all these articles now about these new projects and ideas. And, you know, if Tavern on the Green is your way back in, fine. But yeah, it's just another.
But he pissed people there. Off there.
Well, he's got this certain atmosphere that he likes in his kitchen. You cannot serve quality good food routinely if you don't own the kitchen, if you don't command the kitchen. And his command would work if he owned the restaurant, but he didn't own Tavern on Green. He couldn't really call the shots, and that made him very angry and created a sour atmosphere. Compared to last week's food documentary I saw, In Search of Israeli Cuisine, this one's a lot better. It's just engaging. I don't cook. I don't care anything about food, but I like a documentary about interesting people. And Jeremiah Tower's an interesting guy. Not as good as Finding Oscar, but I dug it.
Yeah, no, it kept me engaged. I thought the first half and the flashback stuff didn't track very well. I just felt that it had all these different devices. They would throw in these long philosophical shots of him staring out a window with snow falling and some voiceover of some poetry. He's a very poetic guy, but he's also a jerk. And you definitely see you like him despite yourself, and you understand why other people liked him. And it's fascinating to see how his relationships with other people, that people kind of had this divide of you admired him. The one woman who owned the original, the Panisse restaurant, was the idea is that she might have been sort of a jilted, that she had a romantic interest in him. He fostered that for a little while, even though he was also gay. And so his sexuality sort of is interspersed throughout this in terms of his relationships with men and women and chefs and other people. And his self-awareness as to what his limitations were and why people don't necessarily like him. It was very interesting to me towards the end that he's completely aware of why he pisses people off, but he's going to continue to do it anyway because that's just who he is. So I agree. As documentaries go, both of these films very different, but both quite engaging.
Well, our third film, I don't think you saw. So I think, and I'm nervous actually to do this solo because it's called Below Her Mouth, and it's about lesbians. And technically, this is by, for, and about women. I really have no place on earth to be reviewing this film, but I watched it, and I want to tell you what I thought about it.
Please.
First of all, it's unique. Female director, female writer, and an entire female production crew. Okay, you have my attention. The director's called, her name's April Mullen, and it was written by a lady named Stephanie Fabrizi. Two main characters. Dallas, played by Erica Linder. I think this is her first acting role. Sounds like she's Swedish because there's an accent in there. I think she's a model, and she looks, she's got this icy stare and this platinum blonde hair, and she's a roofer. She owns her own roofing company. Don't mess with Dallas. Then there's Jasmine.
Mm-hmm.
Jasmine, played by Natalie Krill, is engaged. She's engaged and with the biggest ring you've ever seen, and he goes off on a work trip.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And she's rich. She is, I'm a fashion magazine editor. But she never goes to work, you know, but she's a fashion magazine editor. The reason I'm making fun of this is because the story is ridiculous. It is, the dialogue is atrocious. I've got no emotional stamina for intimacy. Dallas is, like every other guy you've seen in a movie, playing the field. No girl can settle me down. I've got a lot of catching up to do. Can't chase me. And then boom, takes one look at Jasmine, falls head over heels in love, and they spend a long weekend together. Jasmine, very unsure.
Conflicted, I'm sure.
Very conflicted. Mm-hmm. She keeps saying, I'm straight, though. I'm straight. But let's make out some more. Below Her Mouth is extremely explicit. 70% of this film are two girls doing it. Just carnal knowledge all over the screen. This is more explicit than anything I think you'd see on Cinemax at nighttime. This is really explicit. And you know what? Fine. What I wanted to compare and contrast is what a lot of people have been talking about. This is women showing women. And a lot of times people get upset. Like, blue is the warmest color. That was a man directing two girls. And this is a man's idea of lesbian love. It was all soft. It's all intimate. It's all quiet. There's nothing soft and intimate about Below Her Mouth. These girls are just straight up doing it all over the place. And it's rough. And so I guess, okay, that's how women want this to be portrayed. Power to you. But make it a good story. Make it a good movie and I'm on board. This is not good.
But there was absolutely nothing about this movie that appealed to me when I just read the synopsis, which is why I was like, okay, this one's going to be all yours next week. Because I knew, I just had absolutely no interest in seeing it. I wonder how it compares to something like Carol that, you know.
Doesn't compare.
So, but I mean, that one, see, and that was.
But that had story.
That had story. So, I mean, that one was, I thought.
And good actresses.
Was well done. Had really good actresses. I'd never heard of any of these people. So to me,
and
reading.
And you never will.
Exactly. So to me, like, just even reading the blurb about it and seeing who was in it, there was just absolutely nothing that would make me feel like I needed to go see it. And, you know, so I figured also just the title itself is visually.
You know, it's trying to tell you something with that title.
Yes.
But it's really, it doesn't come up in the film. You don't know why it has that title. You know what it's alluding to, but it's a stupid illusion. It doesn't even work.
And it's kind of a gross illusion. There's just absolutely nothing about.
Well, technically, it must be talking about her neck. It just doesn't work. Or her chin.
Oh, I think it's talking about something else.
I get it, but it doesn't. It doesn't work.
Yeah, but so there are certain times where I have the opportunity to potentially see something, but I go, you know what? There's just absolutely no reason to it. And if Charlie loves it, or other people tell me that it's really great, maybe I go back and consider it, especially if it's an award season type of thing. But when it's, you know, coming out at this doldrum time right now and has absolutely nothing of appeal, I am just going to plain old skip it and save myself the 2 hours.
It has a 25% on Rotten Tomatoes, so the vast majority of the world agrees with me. But the Washington Post, and I'm not talking about one of the three main writers, Anne Hornaday, Michael O'Sullivan, Stephanie Mary. They didn't see it. They pawned it off on a guest writer, and he gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars. And I'm scouring the review. I'm reading the review. We obviously saw the same film, and he liked it. He borderline loved it. And he comes out and says the story is stupid and the dialogue is stupid.
I know. And so
he loved it.
I saw that this morning. I read the review. I saw that he'd given it 3.5 stars. And I thought, oh my gosh, is Charlie going to like this one? And I'm going to have to sit here and listen to you rave about a movie I missed. And so when I saw that too, I was shocked when you mentioned that you did not particularly care for it. And so I'll be curious to see whether this particular guest writer makes many more appearances.
I mean, I've seen him there before, but it's rare. But I was confounded.
But you know what?
I was confused.
That's movies for you. To each his or her own. If he enjoyed it, if someone else, if those 25% of the people from Rotten Tomatoes, if 25% of the people want to see it and like it, that's great. But I suspect that the majority of people, as Rotten Tomatoes would show, they're just not going to go see it.
Well, I hope, Cinema Clash audience, you enjoyed our limited release week of 2 documentaries and a Canadian independent film and our water.
Water.
I mean, it's just that's how it is this week. It happens sometimes.
You know, it is what it is. Next week, though,
we'll be back.
We make up for it.
With a Marvel film, we'll jump back into blockbusters. But this one, you know, just it's a week that was.
It was.
So, quick recap. Finding Oscar, I think, is the best film of the week. It's stomach-churning, but it's a story you probably need to know.
I agree.
Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent. You know, it's there for an interesting character study, but it's not very impactful.
If you watch the Food Network, you might be interested.
Below Her Mouth. Probably a movie scene on a dare. I would think it's not, you know, could it achieve cult classic status? I suppose, you know, it's so bad it's good. One of those things.
Maybe, or just go and watch the new unrated version of, you know, the 50 Shades movies that are now out there.
That's not an alternative, Hannah. That is not an alternative. All right. Well, on behalf of Cinema Clash, I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend at RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.